I think lots of people who think that Christianity is for a certain kind of person, you need to be of a certain kind of disposition to be attracted to the Christian life. And I think there's lots and lots of people who say, well, the Christian life is all right for them. They lean that way. They have that kind of disposition and personality. It lends itself to that, to them becoming Christians. But I'm fairly different. And it would never work for me. I think there's lots of people who think like that in relation to Christianity. Yet the truth is, both the Bible and history are replete or full of examples of people who came from very, very different walks of life to embrace Christ for themselves and who became Christians. I mean, even in the Bible, we could think of Acts chapter 10, a gentleman called Cornelius. We're told in Acts chapter 10 that he was a good man. He didn't do anything blatantly evil. He was a good man. We're told that he was a praying man. He prayed three times a day. He would stop in the middle of the day and have a prayer time again in the evening, first thing in the morning. He was a praying man. We're told that he was a kind man. When he walked down the street and he saw someone begging, asking for money, he would stop and take out his purse and give that person money. He was generous. He gave to the poor. He gave to those who were in need. He was a good person, but the Bible tells us that he wasn't actually a saved person, or he wasn't a Christian person, until Peter and John went down and preached the gospel to him, and he heard the gospel explained to him, and then he embraced Jesus. So there's an example of a good person, certain kind of person at least, and when he hears the gospel, he embraces Jesus for himself. Well, on the other end of the spectrum, you could think about the woman at the well, couldn't you, at the beginning of John's gospel? Full of brokenness and emptiness, who's had five husbands and is now just living with someone who's got a live-in lover, whether she moved in with him or he moved in with her, I don't know the story, but full of brokenness, disappointment, five different husbands, all of them promising her the world, no doubt, and all of them, all five of them shattering her dreams, and maybe one or two of them died, but it's hard to believe that all five of them died. And I think that she has been involved in broken relationships. She comes to the well in the middle of the day when the sun is at its hottest. Nobody did that in their right mind. She did that because she didn't want to meet people. She was the subject of people's gossip. Yet Jesus comes along and sits down beside her and begins to talk to her as if she really matters, as if she's the most important person in the world. And he reaches into her sad and sorry heart and gives her life in all of its fullness. And she goes back into her village and says, "Come and see a man who told me everything that I've ever done." And he gives her this water to drink and tells her if she drinks it, she'll never thirst again, not physically, but spiritually, because there's an emptiness in her heart that only Jesus can fill. So there's two people from very different walks of life, wouldn't you think? A good man, Cornelius, and this woman at the well, full of brokenness. And what is true in the Bible is also true in history. I mean, I don't know where to start in digging up examples from history of people who came from different walks of life. You could think about someone like John Newton, a barbaric, drunken slave trader, stealing people from Africa, selling them here in Great Britain. Hated by everyone, including the crew on the ship that he was the captain of, or that he was the first mate of. They detested him. But one night in the middle of a raging storm, God breaks into his life as he sits in the helm of the ship. God breaks into his life and forgives him and transforms him and completely turns him around. But then on the other end of the spectrum, I could think about someone like John Wesley, went as a missionary to the state of Georgia. And he writes in his diary on one occasion, "I went to convert the Indians, but who, oh God, will convert me? Who's going to convert me? I'm the missionary preacher. And I too need to be converted. And who's going to share the message with me?" And of course he comes back to London and He's sitting listening to the, is it the preface of Luther's commentary on Romans being read in Aldersgate in London, and his heart is strangely warmed as the gospel begins to grip him, and he too is born again by God's grace. So there's two people from very different backgrounds and very different walks of life who come to embrace Christ. And in this passage that I've read for you this morning, Matthew is really sharing with us his testimony. He tells us how he heard the call of Jesus to come and follow, and how he left everything to follow Jesus. He's been telling us in his gospel a little bit about the difference that Jesus has made in different people's lives. He's been telling us how Jesus healed someone from leprosy. He's been telling us about the paralyzed man, or the man that was suffering from paralysis, and he was lowered at the feet of Jesus. Remember that story? And Jesus had healed this man with paralysis, and he got up and took up his bed and off he took. He's been telling us about how Jesus delivered a man who was demon-possessed and set him free from the controlling power of demon possession. So he's been telling us about the difference that Jesus made in lots of different lives, and now he wants us to hear about the difference that Jesus made in his life. Now he wants to tell us how Jesus revolutionized his life and his heart, how he met Jesus and how he began to start following Jesus. And isn't it a great, great thing to have a testimony? I don't know if you've got a testimony this morning. Can you look back to a time in your life when you heard the call of Jesus, or the call of the gospel, to become one of his disciples, and you gave your life to Jesus, and you asked Jesus to become your Savior and to forgive you and to change you? Can you look back to a day like that in your life? It's a great thing to be able to look back to such a day. But maybe you can't, because there's never been such a day. You know what the really exciting news is? Today could be that day. 20 years from now, you could look back to that morning sitting in People's Evangelical Church when that strange preacher came from Edinburgh, and you heard Jesus speak to you from the pages of the Bible, and you gave your life to Jesus, and that was the day that you became a Christian. That's the exciting thing about this great story. Well, I want to try and just leave three things with you this morning, and I'll try and be as quick as I can. I want you to think, first of all, about the call of the Master, a little bit about the change in Matthew, and then finally, a little bit about the criticism of the Pharisees. So those are the three things. The call of Jesus, the change in Matthew, and the criticism of the Pharisees. And we'll begin by looking at the call of the Master. So this incident comes after the healing of the man who had been paralyzed. And you know how that story unfolded. The crowds were around the house where Jesus was preaching. It was probably Peter's house in Capernaum. Crowds were everywhere. They were in the doorways. They were at the windows. And these four friends decided that they were going to bring along this gentleman who was paralyzed to Jesus, because they'd heard the stories of how Jesus could heal people. And they decided that they wanted to see if Jesus could heal their friend. And so they carried him to the house where Jesus was preaching. They couldn't get in. They climbed up on the roof. They dug a hole in the roof and they lowered their friend at the feet of Jesus. And it was quite a remarkable story. And in the aftermath of that event, Jesus, of course, not only healed him, but forgave his sins. In the aftermath of that event, Jesus went for a walk along the shores of the Sea of Galilee. And that's where this story that we have read about takes place. Now, Jesus is walking along the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and he has this encounter with this gentleman called Matthew. Two things that I want you to pick up on with me in regard to the call of the Master. The first is this: the call was unexpected. He walks along the shore and he sees this man sitting at a tax collector's booth or tax collector's desk. This gentleman is collecting taxes for the Roman government. Now, I don't know what he was collecting taxes on. Maybe he was collecting taxes on the number of fish that was caught in the Sea of Galilee. I think what is more possible is that he was sitting at a on a fairly busy trade route, and that trade was moving from one jurisdiction into another jurisdiction, and as goods were passing through from out of his territory or either into his territory, then he was collecting taxes on these goods and say, yeah, you can pass here, but here's what it will cost you to move from this jurisdiction into this jurisdiction. I think that makes more sense to me, having read some of the stuff around this. But anyway, whatever he was collecting taxes on, he was a tax collector. Now, in today's society, you know, being a tax collector is a fairly upstanding job within society. If you're a tax collector, you're usually a fairly decent sort of person, and you probably wear a nice suit to work and all of that. But in Bible times, it was a fairly different world. You didn't just show up with a tie and a suit and get an interview and say, yeah, we'll employ you. It was a murky sort of world. There were all kinds of bribery involved, a little bit of backhanders here. Yeah, you can become a tax collector if you pay us so much. And then when you became a tax collector, you could recoup everything that you had paid out. And that was the kind of world that Matthew belonged to. And these tax collectors had a reputation for lining their own pockets. They took more than they should have. They didn't hand everything into the government. They kept a little for themselves. And they had liberty to do that. They could put it down to their own expenses. And the Roman government allowed them to recoup their own expenses. And that was the kind of world that Matthew belonged to. Not only had they a reputation for stealing, but they were also viewed as being those that worked for the enemy. They were defectors. They were working for the occupying forces. They had turned against their own people. They were gathering money from their own people and handing it to the Romans who had invaded Palestine or Israel. I mean, they were as popular as somebody working for the British government would be working in somewhere like in Baghdad or some other city maybe in Syria. Not very popular in Israel. And Jesus sees him sitting behind his tax desk and walks past him and says, come and follow me. It's remarkable. Come and follow me. Come and join my intimate circle of friends. There will be just 12 of them. And I am inviting you to become one of my disciples. Come and follow me, Jesus said to this tax collector. And we ask the question, why a tax collector, Jesus? I mean, why invite a tax collector to be one of your 12 disciples? Why not invite one of those four men that carried their friend to you just a few minutes ago? Look at their faith. Wouldn't one of them have made a great disciple? Why not the paralyzed man himself? He would have been a great disciple. He could have gone around testifying to what you did in his life. He could have stood up front and shared an amazing story. He would have been a great disciple. Why a tax collector? Why someone who belongs to this group of people, this strata of society, why a tax collector, Jesus? It's a fair question. And the answer to the question is, why would Jesus call anyone? Not why would Jesus call a tax collector? The truth is, all of us are broken. And all of us are sinful. And all of us are undone. And all of us are in the same boat. And it's a sinking boat. And God has mercy. Romans 9:15, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. You know what? God calls people to come and follow him. Not because of who they are, but because of who he is. And he is a God of extravagant, outrageous grace, who gives and gives and gives again. And that's why anybody hears the call of Jesus. It's because of who he is. It's because he's a God of mercy. And maybe you're here and you think to yourself, you know what? I'm not sure I'm good enough to become a Christian. None of us are good enough. None of us. God calls you to become one of his disciples, one of his followers, one of his children, to experience his forgiveness, not because you're good enough, but because he's good enough. Because he's gracious, and because he loved us enough to send his son to the cross to make it possible for us to be born again. Well, here's the second thing. If the call was unexpected in regard to the call of the Master, then the response was unreserved, wasn't it? I'm not sure if Matthew ever spoke to Jesus prior to this incident in his life. There's no record of it in the Bible, in the Gospels, no record anywhere of Matthew having had a conversation with Jesus. Now, it's possible that he had heard about Jesus. I think it would have been difficult to have lived in Capernaum and not to have heard of Jesus, given all the miracles that Jesus has been performing. But this may have been Matthew's first encounter with Jesus, but the wonder of it all is this. Having potentially never met Jesus before, he was challenged to take the risk and to step out by faith and follow Jesus, and that is exactly what he did. It was a costly decision. I want you to think about this from Matthew's perspective. He's in a fairly lucrative position. He can basically earn as much money as he wants to earn. Now, you see Peter and Andrew and James and John? When Jesus called them to leave their fishing boats and fishing nets and follow him, you know what? They could go back to their fishing boats and fishing nets at any time. Because their fishing boats and fishing nets were waiting on the shores of the Sea of Galilee for them whenever they decided to go back to them. And indeed, later in the Gospel, they did go back fishing. Peter says, I'm going back fishing, John 21, and seven of them, or six of them, went with him. So they could go back. But see, Matthew, if he leaves that tax desk, there's no going back. Because there is no way that the Romans will allow taxes to go uncollected. They will have someone in his seat as before it cools, before evening is out, he will be replaced. Matthew, if you leave your tax collecting job, there's no going back for you. This is all or nothing. All or nothing. Yet the amazing thing is he gets up from his tax desk and he begins to follow Jesus. But then I ask this question, what fool would have sat at a tax desk when you've just been called by the King of Kings and the King of the universe? Who would sit at a tax desk when you've just heard the call of Jesus? And yet the truth is, many, many people are doing that. They hear the call of Jesus to come and follow, and they sit on at their tax desk. Whatever that might be, whatever that looks like for you, whether it's a lifestyle or I don't know what it is, but people sit on and refuse and reject the call of Jesus. But what a terrible mistake. Jesus is offering eternal life to those who come to him, who are weary and heavy laden. He offers eternal life. Who would reject a call like that? Well, here's the second thing. It's the change in Matthew. This is what really strikes me. The change in Matthew. Now, there were different kinds of tax collectors. It seems that there were folks like Zacchaeus. He's kind of got tax collectors under him. But Matthew is the kind of tax collector who's at the coal face. He's involved in interacting with people. Two things about Matthew, having met Jesus, having heard the call to follow him, and having left his tax collecting job and begun to follow him. Two things that strike me in regard to the change in Matthew. First of all, is his desire. In verse 10, we move from a scene by the Sea of Galilee to a scene probably back in Capernaum in Matthew's house. And I think the scene that greets us back in Capernaum tells us a lot about Matthew and what has happened to him. Well, first of all, Matthew invited Jesus and a number of others to go back to his home for an evening meal. That's what we're told. Jesus is sitting in Matthew's house having a meal with Matthew and his friends and some of the disciples. And the religious leaders don't like the fact that Jesus has gone home with Matthew. But surely Jesus didn't just invite himself back to Matthew's house. I mean, I think Jesus was capable of that. I think Jesus was the kind of person that could invite himself anywhere. But I don't think Jesus invited himself to Matthew's house. I think what's going on here is Matthew invites Jesus, come back to my house because I want you to meet my friends. And I want my friends to meet you. Because Matthew believes with all of his heart that Jesus is worth meeting. He believes that with all of his heart. Jesus is worth meeting. I want you to meet my friends, and I want my friends to meet you. And he invites them to come back to his house. What a great thing is unfolding here in Matthew chapter 9. What a great, great thing. You know, I have been a Christian now for well over 30 years. That's a long time. But I want to say this to you, that I have no regrets about becoming a Christian as a young boy of 11. No regrets. If I had 1,000 lives, if I had 1,000 lives, I'd give every single one of them to Jesus. Because Jesus is worth knowing and he is worth serving. And the hope of glory burns in our hearts. And I just stand in places like this on a weekly basis and more, because I really think that Jesus is worth meeting. And if I didn't think that, I wouldn't stand in a pulpit like this. I wouldn't lie to people. I believe that with all my heart. Just like Matthew did. Come and meet Jesus. Jesus, come and meet my friends. Jesus is the greatest treasure in Matthew's life. He wouldn't have left his tax collecting job to follow Jesus if he didn't think Jesus was worth it. He thinks Jesus is worth it. He thinks Jesus is of infinite more value than the money he was making in his tax collecting job. He thinks that Jesus is worth meeting. And there's a great challenge in that for all of us, isn't there? There's a challenge in that for me. I'm a Christian. I live in Edinburgh. Like, how many times have I invited my little neighbour in for a barbecue and a few Christian friends around and said, come and hear a little bit about Jesus from them? How often have you done that? Isn't that something all of us could do? Just open up our homes and say, come round and have coffee. I'd love to tell you about Jesus. It is possible to introduce your friends to Jesus. You know, when I was a pastor in Canada, this is a true story. Two girls came to work in an apple orchard not far from where our church was. And they started to attend our church on Sunday morning. And a girl had come from the Czech Republic to work on the same apple orchard. And those two girls had actually come from the middle of Canada and they were working on this apple orchard. They took an interest in this girl from the Czech Republic. They prayed for her. They loved her. They took her to town. They gave her books to read. They just spent time with her. And one Sunday morning she came to church. And it was a straightforward message. It wasn't particularly evangelistic. But that morning after church, she asked if she could talk to us, and she gave her life to Jesus. And everybody in church thought, oh, this is great. Someone has responded to the preaching of the word, and yes, it was great. But behind that story was the witness of those two girls who said, we want you to meet Jesus. Because Jesus is worth meeting. Well, that's the desire. What about the dedication? As you look at Matthew sitting at his tax desk, you say to yourself, well, what good will he be to Jesus? He's a tax collector. Isn't Jesus looking for preachers and missionaries? All this man can do is record facts. He's a statistician. He's good with his pen. He's a keeper of records. He's at best when he's sitting behind a table, not standing behind a pulpit. And we might be tempted to think that Jesus is making a terrible mistake. Aren't you looking for 12 fiery preachers and missionaries that will go across the face of the earth with the gospel? Why in the world would you call a man who's good at recording facts? I mean, you don't read in the book of Acts of Matthew preaching any great outstanding sermon. He's not that kind of character. So why did Jesus call this man called Matthew? Well, I just want you to think about this. This man, Matthew, is good at recording facts. And he that day that when Jesus called him, he just gave his pen to Jesus and he said, here I am. If you can take me and use me, I am at your disposal. And Jesus took Matthew and took his pen and his ability to record facts. And that man called Matthew, by the help of God, gave us a gospel that is second to none. Did you know that if it wasn't for the gospel of Matthew, we would never have received the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6 and 7, a classic piece of literature. If it hadn't been for Matthew, we would never have heard about his journey into Egypt as a little child. We'd never have heard some of the great stories that he told, the wise and foolish builder. We'd never have heard about the wheat and the tares, the story of the unforgiving servant, the story of the two sons, not the prodigal son and the older brother, but the other story about the two sons, one who was asked to do something and said he would do it and didn't do it. Remember that story? The story of the great banquet, the story of the five wise and foolish virgins, the story of the sheep and the goat. Matthew is the one that records all of that. And you say, why? Because that's his gift. He's good at that. He's good at recording facts. And he gives his pen to Jesus, and Jesus takes him and uses him. And that encourages me. As a little boy from a dysfunctional home here on the east coast of Scotland, what I'm encouraged about is that Jesus could take someone like me and use me. And I am absolutely convinced, no matter who you are, where you're from, or what your background is, or what your gifts are, what your education is like, I am absolutely convinced that Jesus has a work for you to do right here in Peebles. He can take you and your pen, or whatever it is you're good at, and he can use it for his glory and for his purposes if we only put it at his disposal. Here's the last thing, and with this we'll be finished. It's the concern of the Pharisees. Somehow a number of the Pharisees became aware that Jesus was eating with tax collectors and sinners, and they were concerned about the company that Jesus was keeping. This is terrible. Look at who he's eating with now. This is shocking. He should never be doing this. He should be eating food with us. We're the kind of people he should be going home with, not these rascals. Who were the Pharisees? Well, the Pharisees were a group of people who had formed themselves together into a group known as the Pharisees, obviously, and they were dedicated to keeping Israel pure. They were particularly dedicated to keeping the law, and they had worked it all out in its finer details. They had a book known as the Mishnah, which had a whole list of rules and regulations about what you could do and what you couldn't do, and all of that was to safeguard the law of God. And they just didn't think that Jesus should have been going home with Matthew and his friends. What if Matthew and his friends bought the food that they were serving to Jesus with money that hadn't been tithed? What if all of the dietary regulations surrounding the preparation and serving of food and the kind of food that you should eat, what if it didn't match the dietary regulations of the Old Testament? I mean, it's just ridiculous that Jesus is going home with Matthew from their perspective. Two things, and with this we'll be finished. First of all, they misunderstood Jesus. They misunderstood Jesus. Jesus says, "Who is it that needs a doctor? Who needs a doctor? It's sick people that need a doctor. You don't go and help people who are well if you're in the medical world. They don't need to see you. You go to the sick people." And Jesus is saying to these folks, "You've completely misunderstood me. I came into the world not to condemn. The world is already condemned. They are already condemned. I've come to bring spiritual help to those who are in spiritual need, who are spiritually sick. I've come to be a spiritual physician to those who are spiritually sick." And isn't that true? Isn't that what Jesus has come to do, to set us free from the power of sin, from the pollution of sin, and one day from the very presence of sin? You know, my grandfather lived in Edinburgh and ended up a drunk on the streets of Edinburgh, homeless. And when I think about Jesus delivering people from the power of sin, I wonder this. I wonder if anybody ever told him about Jesus. Because I know that he tried to break free from alcohol addiction on several occasions, but was never successful. And I wonder if anyone ever told him, Jesus delivers from the power of sin. Jesus says to these religious leaders, who needs a doctor? It's the sick that need a doctor. And I've come to minister to these broken people. Now, if you're here and you're a bit like me, and you sense your own brokenness, and you don't need someone to tell you that you're a sinner, because you know in the quietness of your heart that you've disappointed God. I am not here to give you a pat on the back, but I am here to tell you this. Jesus is the friend of sinners. Jesus is the friend of sinners. And Jesus specializes in breaking into their lives and transforming them and setting them free and setting them off in a new direction. They misunderstood Jesus, and secondly, they misunderstood themselves. Now, when Jesus said, who needs a doctor? It's the sick that need a doctor. He wasn't saying that they didn't need a doctor. And he wasn't saying that they weren't spiritually sick. And he wasn't saying that they weren't spiritually broken. The point is that these people couldn't see that they were spiritually broken. They thought that they were a step above everyone else. But in various other places, Jesus says, on the outside you look clean and white, but inside you're full of dead men's bones. You're rotten to the core. These people couldn't see their own brokenness and own sinfulness, and they misunderstood themselves. What a terrible, terrible mistake to make, don't you think? To somehow drift through life and think that you are the exception. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Oh, but not me. If all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, it includes me as the preacher. And it includes you. We are spiritually sick. We are spiritually broken. And we need the forgiveness that Jesus can give us. And we need the righteousness that only Jesus can give to us to make us acceptable to the Father. And we need to be reconciled to the Father. We were created to know God. That's why there is so much confusion and emptiness and searching in this world, because there's an emptiness that people don't know how to fill. We were created to know God. And these poor leaders of Israel didn't understand themselves. It's tragic that many of them rejected Christ, don't you think? I think that's absolutely tragic. Let me finish with this story. I heard the story about a little boy who lived on the streets of one of the poorer parts of Calcutta. And one day a missionary was making his way from the mission station into the interior of the country. And on his way through the streets, as he was exiting the city, he bumped into, this little boy. And the little boy knew the missionary, recognized him, and asked him for food and medicine. And the missionary looked at the little boy, could see his big bloated tummy, could see that he was clearly malnourished and clearly ill and in need of help. But he said to the little boy, I'm in a rush. I'm heading into the country. I want you to go back to the mission station and they will help you. The little boy said to the missionary, oh, they'd never help me. I'd knock on the door, they'd take one look, and they'd just turn me away. So the missionary says, well, I'll write you a little note. And when you knock on the door of the mission station, you hand that in and they'll help you. So he wrote the little boy a note, and he gave it to him, and off he went, off into the countryside. Several days later, that little boy was found dead on the streets of Calcutta. But you know what is so tragic? What was so tragic was in his hand there was a little note that said, please give this boy food and medicine. And it was signed by the missionary. And the little youngster perished with the invitation to go and get the help he needed in his hand. He perished with the invitation to go and get the help that he needed in his hand. And I just fear, as I trundle around from place to place, that there are lots and lots of people who hear the invitation of Jesus to go and get the help that they need, but decide to reject it. And my fear is that they're in danger of perishing with the invitation, if not in their hands, and certainly ringing in their ears. And my prayer is that you won't be a person like that.